This is edition number 1981 of the Mardler, recorded in Aylsham on Friday, the 22nd of August, 2025. Hello, you are listening to The Mardler, the weekly talking newspaper for North Norfolk. Today we bring you the week's news and views from the North Norfolk News of Thursday, the 21st of August, 2025. My name is Barbara Calver and my fellow readers are...
Mary Beattie,
Mary Wilson
and Ruth Harrison.
On the notice board today, this week the sun will rise around 5:46 a.m. and we'll set at about 20:09. If you're marking a birthday, an anniversary, or any special moment this week, the whole team here at the Mardler sends you a hearty congratulations and our very best wishes. We would very much like to welcome new listener Jane Ritchie of North Walsham, and we hope you enjoy today's recording.
The magazine supplement will follow a little later in the programme and includes encounters of first vehicles and lucky escapes, visiting the Glaven ports of North Norfolk, a wry look at modern life from a grumpy old man, and our ever popular My Music for You.
But we begin with the main news items, which include fun at Cromer Carnival, councillor attacks whinging estate agents, climate protesters climb gas platform, and plane flips in field. Let's start with the lead stories.
Cromer Carnival 2025 burst into life at the weekend with a packed programme of quirky competitions and family fun. The long-running event, which has been a highlight of the town's summer calendar since the 1960s, once again drew crowds to the carnival field for its traditional opening festivities. On Saturday, August 16th, the fun began with the bake-off competition and the ever-popular novelty dog show. Families and visitors alike gathered to watch with plenty of laughter and applause for the four-legged contestants. Sunday saw one of the most cherished moments of Carnival Week, the crowning of Miss Cromer. This year the title went to Sadie Lee Sumner, who received her crown in front of an enthusiastic audience. The traditional field events, known for their good-natured chaos, also returned in style, and a series of contests kept the crowds entertained. The Bonnie Baby competition proved a crowd favourite, with winners including Casper Rogers, Willow Yanker, and joint winners Eva and Cleo Nichols. The Knobbly Knees contest drew 11 brave entrants, with the crown going to Martz Ai, while the Glamorous Grandmother competition, featuring 10 hopefuls, was won by Michelle Crane. The Children's Fancy Dress competition brought a splash of colour and imagination to the carnival field. Standout winners included Sophia Blomquist, dressed as a tornado, and Rebecca Lane, who impressed as a jellyfish. The overall Robin Seeley Memorial Cup was awarded to Jemima Forrester and Thea Loxley for their inventive spaceship costume. Photographer Andreas Yassimi, who captured the weekend, said, "There have been so many proud moments, big smiles and proper Norfolk fun. Well done to everyone who took part and helped make it happen." The fun continued this week with the much-anticipated Red Arrows display and carnival parade happening yesterday.
A senior councillor has defended Norfolk's controversial second homes levy with a blistering attack on whinging estate agents who have complained about its impact on house prices. Terry Parrish, who was a key architect in pushing for the policy to be introduced in West Norfolk, said the fall in house values should be applauded. It follows property firms warning second homeowners they will have to drop prices by 30% if they are looking to sell, to avoid paying a 100% premium on council tax. Mr. Parrish, who was leader of West Norfolk Council when the scheme was first introduced, said, No one seems to have applauded that result. I do. In an article for this newspaper, he defended the policy from criticism. House prices in second home hotspots are grossly inflated, which may benefit estate agents currently whinging, but makes it all but impossible for locals and their dependents to purchase properties to actually live in and work from, he said. Second homes are hardly a necessity. Having a home is. Whatever can be done to help people get a proper home should be accepted. The former council leader believes the policy of charging double council tax on homes not used as a permanent residence could help unlock hundreds of homes in the county as people look to sell. Conditions preventing new builds from being sold as second homes have also been introduced in several villages in the county. He says this may help reduce further loss of land through new housing developments, with nearly 10,000 planned to be built in West Norfolk alone over the next 20 years. Why should acres of fields be ripped up if a significant proportion of houses built on them become second homes or holiday lets, he added. The housing crisis used to justify government demands to build ever more houses is supposed to be about supplying homes for those who need them to live in, not play in. The same applies to all the infill housing, which takes away gaps between properties and removes smaller green spaces. It will also raise millions of pounds in revenue for cash-strapped local authorities, with a significant portion earmarked for the communities that have been hollowed out by second homes. Government does not fund local services adequately, and councils have to garner money from wherever they can, Mr. Parrish said. That's why the government allowed a second home levy to be made, and why I started that ball rolling in West Norfolk. Second homes have flooded the market following the introduction of the levy. In West Norfolk, there are 52% more homes for sale than there were last year. In North Norfolk, there are 30% more properties than in 2024, according to figures from property firms. Local estate agents say they are sitting on the market as they are still too expensive for locals, while the second home market has fallen as they no longer seen as wise investments. While Mr. Parrish believes there is a lot to be applauded as the effects of the second home levy take hold, critics have warned it could have a disastrous impact on the local economy. Second home owners who are keen to stay have said they are forced to spend less money on local businesses as they seek to cut costs due to paying the additional tax. And firms that rely on income through second homeowners, such as building companies, are expected to see a big drop in trade. Aside from house prices falling along Norfolk's coast, the full effects of the second home tax levy are yet to be realised. Some councils elsewhere in the UK, such as in Wales, where the policy was introduced earlier, have scrapped the charges due to the effects it has had on the economy.
Climate activists boarded a Shell gas platform off the Norfolk coast before spraying 1,000 litres of a blood-red liquid onto a white canvas in a protest against fossil fuels. Greenpeace climbers scaled the North Sea platform 45 miles off the Norfolk coast last week and fastened a giant 12-metre by 8-metre canvas to one side of the structure. The activists then hoisted up a high-pressure hose which pumped out 1,000 litres of a red liquid onto the canvas and into the sea below. The group are calling it the world's first artwork to be installed an active offshore gas site. Designed by artist Anish Kapoor, the artwork is titled Butchered and was in response to heat waves, wildfires and floods in the UK and globally, which Greenpeace say the oil and gas and wider fossil fuel industry is responsible for causing. The blood-like liquid sprayed on the canvas attached to Shell's skiff gas platform was a mix of seawater, beetroot powder and non-toxic food-based pond dye. Greenpeace says the artwork is a stark visualisation of the wound inflicted on both humanity and the earth by the fossil fuel industry. Anish Kapoor, the artist behind the stunt, said he wanted to create something to reflect the butchery that Shell and the fossil fuel industry is inflicting on our planet. Butchered is an action that happens at the place where this violation starts, a gas platform in the middle of the sea, he said. Butchered attempts to bring home the horror, giving voice to the moral and physical destruction caused by ruthless profiteers. My work is also a tribute to the heroic work done in opposition to this destruction and to the tireless activists who choose to disrupt, disagree and disobey. Philip Evans, senior campaigner at Greenpeace UK, said the artwork is a visual gut punch that makes visible the suffering and damage caused by the oil and gas industry right at the place where the harm begins. While the fossil fuel sector makes billions from climate destruction, ordinary people are left to pick up the rising costs of flood damage, droughts and wildfires, he said. Governments need to start holding oil giants like Shell to account and make them pay for the enormous damage they are causing.
An air accident investigation has been carried out after a plane flipped upside down during a crash in a cornfield in Cromer. The crash happened near Northrop's airfield when an Aeropract A32 Vixen with two passengers on board was struggling to land due to turbulence. On its second touchdown attempt, the aircraft suddenly descended rapidly before landing heavily on its nose wheel. Following this, the 69-year-old pilot then carried out a balked landing go-round and returned to the air. During this manoeuvre, he discovered that the rudder pedals, which control the sideways movement of the aircraft's nose, were jammed. It left him concerned that any further damage to the plane's nose landing gear could lead to it collapsing entirely on another touchdown. Even though the aircraft had a ballistic parachute recovery system, the pilot chose not to activate it, as the outcome would be unknown. According to the report, the passenger was increasingly distressed, so the pilot decided to enact a precautionary landing on the softest soil and springiest crop he could find, a cornfield. He switched off the fuel and battery master switches before touching down, but the plane's landing gear became caught in the crops, flipping the aircraft upside down. Following the crash, both the pilot and his passenger were able to self-evacuate from the aircraft with only minor injuries. The pilot was caught by surprise by the sudden descent during his second approach, as the plane did not suddenly lose altitude when he tried to land for the first time. He added that the landing was as slow as possible in the cornfield and was a more predictable and safer outcome than using the ballistic parachute or landing on a concrete runway. This happened on June 20th, 2024, at 10:15 a.m. According to the report, the pilot had 1,711 hours of experience, of which 32 hours were flying the same type of plane.
A college with a perfect pass rate was among the success stories in the heart of the county on A-level results day. Every student who took A-levels or vocational qualifications at Reefham College came away with a passing grade. More than 8 out of 10 pupils, 86%, earned grades A to C, while two-thirds of vocational qualifications students earned distinctions. Helen McGuinness, college director, said, "These results continue to the college's strong track record of academic excellence. This year, more than 80% of students secured a place at their first choice university, including the University of Cambridge and several Russell Group institutions. There was similar success celebrated at Sheringham High School, where a fifth of the students obtained Norfolk Scholar status. Among its standout students was Matas, who achieved an A in sociology, A in criminology, and B in history. Molly, another of Sheringham's students, gained 4 A grades in art, English literature, history, and EPQ at A level, and an A grade in AS philosophy and ethics. She will be studying history at the University of York. However, Matas showed that university does not always have to be the next step, instead opting to go into employment." Dawn Hollidge, head of school at Sheringham, said, "We are very pleased with the achievements of all our students in an increasingly competitive exam context. Students made good progress, and there are some outstanding individual and departmental performances. Congratulations to all our students, and thank you to all parents, carers, and staff for their invaluable support."
A pub on the banks of the River Bure has been handed a 1-star food hygiene rating following a recent inspection. The New Inn in Lower Street, Horning, was visited by a food standards agency inspector at lunchtime on July the 16th. The inspector awarded the Broads Pub the low rating, meaning major improvement necessary. While the hygienic handling of food, including preparation, cooking, reheating, cooling and storage, was rated as good, the cleanliness and condition of the facilities and building were found to need major improvement. This category covers the layout, ventilation, hand washing facilities and pest control required to enable good food hygiene. The management of food safety was found to be generally satisfactory. This relates to the checks in place to ensure food sold or served is safe to eat, as well as staff knowledge of food safety and the confidence of the food safety officer that standards will be maintained. The report shows that the kitchen and the outdoor bin area were inspected, and that the next full inspection will take place within the next 10 months. 2 legal requirements were issued. The first was that the raw meat area must not hold the tin opener in order to prevent cross-contamination. The second was that fly screens must be used on doors or windows if they are used for ventilation. The inspector also ordered immediate action to address waste accumulation, with an abatement notice served on July the 17th. Other recommendations included storing eggs in the fridge, using an allergen matrix, and using a pedal bin with a lid. Food hygiene ratings range from 0 to 5. A score of 1 means major improvement is necessary. The management of the New Inn was approached, but declined to comment.
A North Norfolk couple has lost their appeal to continue running a holiday let from their garden, but say they are not giving up the fight. Mark Short and his husband, Lawrence Wolfe, had converted an outbuilding at their home in Swayfield into a 1-bedroom B&B, which hosted more than 120 guests in its first year. North Norfolk District Council refused retrospective planning permission last year, citing inadequate parking space and poor visibility from the driveway, as well as concerns over nutrient neutrality. The couple then appealed the decision to the Planning Inspectorate. A planning inspector has now dismissed the couple's appeal, but agreed the driveway was not a reason to refuse the application. The holiday let remains blocked, however, due to nutrient neutrality rules. The property lies within the River Bure Ant Broads catchment area, meaning the applicants must prove it will not add harmful nutrient loads to the water system. Mr. Short said they are planning to install a £10,000 water treatment centre, which they believe will address the issue and allow them to reapply. But they face additional costs for a new application and architectural drawings. And Mr. Short says a controversial new condition has been added by the County Council's highway team. It states that if an appeal is allowed, the site's vehicular access must be upgraded within 120 days and approved drainage to ensure highway safety and traffic flow. Mr. Short said, "This is not acceptable and we demand justification for this condition. In what way is this proportionate for adding one more car to a one-car family and driveway, which has already been in existence for a very long time? It feels like red tape methods are being used to stop us from achieving our goal. If it were that important, why was this not part of the original refusal? We are just two people wishing to make a small living by offering two persons nightly bed and breakfast."
Plans for a new recycling centre could be heading back to the High Court after a family-run business asked to appeal a judge's decision to reject their case against the scheme. Martin and Oliver Reed, who run Hilltop Outdoor Centre in North Norfolk, hope for another chance to convince a judge that Norfolk County Council acted unlawfully over plans for a new tip in fields next to their business. The pair's legal experts had argued, in London's Royal Courts of Justice, that the council failed to follow proper and lawful processes when deciding and agreeing Sheringham Recycling Centre should move from its current site off Holt Road in Beeston Regis to fields opposite. Mrs. Justice Leven dismissed all the grounds Hilltop's barristers argued and said consideration of alternatives was legally adequate. But the Reeds have applied for permission to appeal her decision. The crux of their application is that the council did not properly consider alternative sites and failed to present full information to the planning committee, which approved the plans in May last year. The Reeds say there were at least three viable alternatives to the one the council decided on, which will see County Hall paying £20,000 a year in rent to Denny's Construction. The council's own documents showed the applicant, County Hall's own waste department, had alluded to assessments in 2019, which brought forward three potential options, but no copy of those assessments was provided. The site earmarked for the new recycling centre is on land defined as part of a national landscape, previously described as areas of outstanding natural beauty, which Conservative-run County Hall acknowledged was against normal policy. Planning officers said they could not categorically say that no land was available outside the national landscape, and would have expected a more recent site selection assessment to have been provided. But despite that, officers recommended approval, saying great weight needed to be attached to the need for essential infrastructure, and permission was granted. Hilltop's owners say two alternative sites belonged to owners who were willing to sell or rent land, and one was outside the national landscape. They say a site next to the current tip was considered for a possible extension to the tip in 2016, but in 2019, a tree specialist said the woodland was established and mature, so it was not suitable. Its owner had been willing to sell or rent part of it to the council and had held discussions about it, along with another patch of land to the east of the site. Mr. Reed said no written record of any study was kept, while an industrial site in Stonehill Way in Cromer was rejected without a detailed assessment. Martin Reed said, "The attitude from Norfolk County Council has been a callous and careless disregard of their own policies and rules, and an attack on Hilltop for daring to stand up for honesty, transparency, accountability, as opposed to hubris, self-serving reports and obfuscation. The selection of this site is against national and local government policies and the protection of the countryside." This newspaper asked Norfolk County Council a series of questions, including about the various site assessments and how the preferred site was arrived at. The council did not answer those, but said, "All details related to our planning application and site selection processes are publicly available documents, including the outcome of the judicial review. We are not able to comment further on this matter while legal proceedings are ongoing."
Our next few news stories include Pub announces 3-day summer festival, NHS Trust's strongest CQC result in 10 years, Town's new miniature railway launched, and tribute to former fire chief.
A play exploring personal struggles with mental health is set to tour across 2 counties this autumn. Matt, written and directed by Peter Dewar, premiered in June at St George's Theatre in Great Yarmouth and was initially scheduled for a 2-night run. Following a strong audience response, it will now tour venues across Norfolk and Suffolk. Mr Dewar said, "I'm thrilled to be taking Matt to all these places. It's very much my story, but I didn't feel ready to play the part myself when it was first staged. The experiences I went through were too recent and too raw. But now the time seems right, and I will be supported by a cast of 4 professional actors in telling a story that I know people will find uplifting. If there's one thing I would like audiences to take away from Matt, is that it is possible to overcome seemingly impossible challenges with the help of others. I had a lot of positive feedback from the first shows, from people telling me how much it had helped them. I want the play to inspire people who are struggling to seek the support that will get them through it." The play tells the story of Mr. Dewar's own experiences with depression, anxiety, and addiction to prescription painkillers. It follows his journey towards recovery and highlights the importance of support from family, friends, and the wider community. Audience members will have access to mental health information at all venues, with some locations offering in-person support from trained professionals. Mr. Dewar also handled the production's technical and creative elements, including sound design, digital graphics, and promotional materials. He has also written a book detailing his experiences. The tour runs through October and November, with performances at Norwich Theatre Stage 2, Sheringham Little Theatre, Southwold Arts Centre, and the Seagull Theatre in Lowestoft. It will also return to St George's Theatre. Further information and tickets are available at reflectproductionsgy.co.uk.
A North Norfolk pub has announced a 3-day party to mark the end of summer. The Suffield Arms will host Suffield Summer Fiesta to celebrate the last weekend of the holidays with 3 days of sun, music, food and drink, all staged in the pub's extensive garden. The event was inspired by the Suffield's successful Sunday sessions. Music events, which have seen the pub's garden packed with music lovers every month during the summer. International artists will gather at the pub to keep ticket holders dancing all day and night from August the 29th to the 31st. Suffield Summer Fiesta will take place between midday and 11 p.m. on Friday and Saturday, then winding down on Sunday, with 2 bands performing between 1 p.m. and 5 p.m. On Friday, just before dusk, the Global Stars aerobatic team will perform an exclusive daredevil aeroplane stunt display directly above the festival site, culminating in a spectacular fireworks show. The music bill is headlined by sibling trio Kitty, Daisy and Lewis, who will be joined by Bob Log III from Arizona, Reckless Eric, Cosmic Americana from The Hanging Stars and Reggae Blues from Errol Linton. They will be joined by The Vagaband, up-and-coming rock performers Vieira and The Silvers, and Big Steve and his band The Arlenes. The Suffield Arms has built a reputation for its classic Mediterranean-inspired menu, and for the fiesta it will be moved into the garden and made even bigger. There will be a Mediterranean hog roast, a seafood paella stand, a barbecue, an oyster champagne and tapas bar selling an array of the Suffield staple tapas dishes, and an ice cream stand. Tickets cost £33 for adults, and entry is free for children up to the age of 14.
The leader of Norfolk County Council, who sparked outrage over her Stakegate Facebook post, will not be the Conservatives' candidate in elections for the region's first mayor. Instead, Suffolk Police and Crime Commissioner Tim Passmore has been announced as the party's candidate after he was selected. Former Suffolk County Council leader Colin Noble had also been in the running alongside Norfolk County Council leader Kay Mason Billing. The announcement was made after a posh dinner scandal where Mrs. Mason Billing had been subject to a controversy dubbed Stakegate after a Facebook post that she said was a private joke. She apologised but said it had been taken out of context. She said she and her husband self-deprecatingly referred to themselves as poor people to their friends. Nick Clark, chairman of the Norfolk and Suffolk Mayoral Candidate Selection Council, said, "Over the course of three lively hustings, many of you had a chance to meet our candidates in person. I am delighted to share that more than 1,000 of you took part in choosing our candidate for Mayor of Norfolk and Suffolk."
An assessment of two key parts of the region's Mental Health Trust has produced its strongest results in a decade. The Care Quality Commission, CQC, inspected community and crisis services provided by the Norfolk and Suffolk NHS Foundation Trust earlier this year. And while it found some areas of concerns remain, it rated community services as good and highlighted some areas of improvement in crisis care. Trust bosses have hailed the results as the best in the past decade and insist it will not be complacent, but campaigners remain cautious. During the COVID pandemic, the Trust pioneered a crisis line which remains available via 111 option 2. It's since been rolled out nationally and has become a 24-hour service. However, the inspection found that patients are waiting an average of 6 minutes for these calls to be answered, almost 2 minutes slower than the national average. Another concern highlighted in the report was the way the Trust responds to those most urgently in need of referral. NHS mental health organisations are given a target of assessing emergency referrals within 4 hours. However, the report reads, the service did not always meet the national standard for 4 hours from emergency referral to assessment. The CQC, which regulates health and care services, provides graded rankings for each service it assesses. In the case of the community services, this rating has been boosted from requiring improvements to good, the second highest grading available. While the CQC was satisfied that enough had been done to boost the rating of community services, the same was not said about the crisis department. Inspectors noted that strides had been made and the service had made enough improvements to boost its overall rating. While the inspection has earned the Trust praise, campaigners continue to highlight their concerns. The campaign to save mental health services in Norfolk and Suffolk said the Trust still had a long way to go, something also acknowledged by its own leadership team. A campaign spokesman said, "It's the first time in a long time the Trust is not going backwards in terms of ratings, but it's what we expected. With the amount of time, energy, effort, money and resource that's been poured into improvement over the last decade, we'd hope to see this reflected in CQC ratings. However, on the ground and among service users and carers, we see and hear of limited materialisation of improvement, with people still not receiving effective services, those left in crisis and unnecessarily mental health deaths." Staffing was another area highlighted by the CQC, particularly in the crisis team. A vacancy rate of 20.2% was reported at the time of the inspection, though this has since been reduced to 11.9%. The Trust's long-standing struggles have previously had an impact on its ability to attract workers. It's hoped its improvements will help overcome this. A single role recently advertised by the Trust received 50 applications, suggesting its recruitment drives are starting to see greater success.
A former football coach made a 14-year-old girl feel uncomfortable by repeatedly brushing up against her bottom and bombarding her with suggestive messages a disciplinary panel has heard. Josh Roper, a former youth coach at North Walsham Town Football Club, has been accused of behaving inappropriately towards young female players. He is facing a Teaching Regulation Agency misconduct panel to determine whether his alleged behaviour warrants a teaching ban, with Mr. Roper having previously also been head of PE at Sheringham Community Primary Academy. On Monday, the panel heard a series of allegations against Mr. Roper from one of his former players, known as Child A. The teenager described a pattern of behaviour from Mr. Roper while she was at the club in 2022, between the ages of 14 and 15, which had left her considering quitting the game. She said Mr. Roper would regularly ask her to arrive at training up to 15 minutes early each week to help him set up. She reported he would then regularly brush against her bottom as they collected equipment from a storage container at the training ground, but attempt to make it appear accidental. Asked how certain she was that this was deliberate, she said, "I am pretty certain. An accident happens once, maybe twice, not a number of times. It was normally my bottom, but sometimes my private parts at the front as well. He made it look accidental by brushing past, but it happened far too often to be accidental. It made me feel very uncomfortable." Meanwhile, she added that on one occasion during a training session, he had called her babe and also sent a string of inappropriate messages to her. The panel was shown a number of these, including one in which he commented on a tight pair of shorts she had worn while walking his dog, before asking if she could wear them to training. Child A said Mr. Roper had contacted her through a number of social media platforms, including Twitter and an app called Heja, which is used by sports clubs to communicate with players. She said, "I wanted to give up football as I did not want to have that kind of contact with another coach again. It also made me feel more self-conscious about myself. I went to football to have fun and enjoy myself without feeling as though I was being judged for my appearance." The panel also heard similar allegations from a second former player known as Child B. Her allegations related to incidents during the 2016-2017 football season when she was 16 years old. She said that Mr. Roper had added her on the social media platform Snapchat, and while his communications began as football-related, they progressed to become more sexual. She then claimed he had sent her a photograph of himself without a shirt on, which included the boxer line of his underwear. Child B said Mr. Roper was always friendly with the players at the club, and his messages would go beyond football-related inquiries to the point it felt inappropriate. She added that on more than one occasion, Mr. Roper had touched her inappropriately during pre-match huddles. She said he would touch my lower back area towards my bottom. It would not be unusual for coaches to touch players in a huddle, but you would expect it on the shoulder or upper back. It happened more than once and made me feel really uncomfortable. Mr. Roper is not represented at the panel, but denies some of the allegations brought against him. The hearing continues.
A new seaside attraction is about to take passengers on its first journey with the opening of the Cromer Miniature Railway. The Cromer Miniature Railway Club will run a free preview service over the August bank holiday, giving the public their first chance to ride the brand new 7 1/4 gauge railway. Trains will operate on Sunday, August the 24th and Monday, August the 25th, between 11 a.m. and 4 p.m. The Mayor of Cromer, Richard Leeds, will officially inaugurate the service by driving the first passenger train on Sunday morning. The railway can be accessed via the Amazona Zoo car park off Hall Road or the Pick Your Own entrance. Rides are free, though the club is welcoming donations to help fund the construction of the line. The club, formed in 2020, has spent the last 4 years turning its vision into reality. Many of its members were previously involved with the Ashmanu Light Railway, which closed in 2019. This has been an adventure of epic proportions, starting with a clean slate, a club spokesman said. We hope the railway will be enjoyed by both locals and visitors for years to come. The railway currently boasts several locomotives and 3 carriage sets. As well as providing rides for the public, it will also give local enthusiasts the chance to get hands-on with railway operations. The club is encouraging new members to join, whether they are interested in helping with track work, infrastructure, signalling, rolling stock maintenance, or even training as drivers and guards. Anyone keen to get involved can visit the railway site on Wednesdays and Saturdays from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. or find out more online at www.cromerminiaturerailway.co.uk.
He was a 25-year-old who tragically lost his life while swimming in Wroxham Broad last summer. Now, Henry Keith's legacy will live on after a lifeboat team unveiled new state-of-the-art search technology in his memory. Hemsby Broad's rescue was called out on August 16th last year to assist in the search for Mr. Keith from Hoe near Dereham, when he did not resurface from the water. A major search operation was launched, leading to Mr. Keith's body being recovered 2 days later. In the aftermath of his death, Mr. Keith's family expressed their gratitude to Hemsby Lifeboat and the crew by raising funds in memory of the 25-year-old. Moved by their generosity, the crew decided to invest the donations in £10,000 subsurface search technology to enhance their ability to recover the bodies of loved ones quickly and compassionately. The portable equipment, made by Dorian Marine, allows the crew to get 3D imagery underwater in both the sea and the Broads and has been tested at 18 metres deep. And this week, the family visited the lifeboat station to view the new technology, dedicated in memory to Mr. Keith, and meet the members of the crew involved in the search for him. His father, James Keith, said It has been a great honour to be here to see the dedication from these teams, who are all volunteers, and the time they give up and the equipment they have managed to accumulate. Their annual fundraising is an extraordinary feat. To keep this organisation going is so important. Our small contribution from people who were very generous in supporting this family has enabled Hemsme to buy this kit and hopefully will make other people not have to suffer as much as we did if they were ever in this tragic situation. Chris Batten, chairman of Hemsme Broads Rescue, said, "We are honoured to name this vital new equipment in memory of Henry Keith. His family's kindness ensures that, in future incidents, we can provide faster answers and solace to those enduring the pain of uncertainty. Forgetting the tragedy itself of losing a loved one to drowning, the fact that sometimes you have to wait weeks before a body is recovered, that just adds to the whole stress of the situation with the loss. The quicker, the more safely, and the more respectfully we can recover their loved ones, the better."
Tributes have been paid to a former Norfolk fire chief who's died at the age of 91. Bruce Hogg, who was made OBE, was the former chief fire officer at Norfolk Fire and Rescue Service. In a tribute, Norfolk Fire and Rescue Service said, "We are greatly saddened by the news that our former Chief Fire Officer Bruce Hogg, OBE, O St J, QFSM, has died at the age of 91. Bruce joined us as Deputy Chief Fire Officer in 1974. In 1979, he was appointed as Chief Fire Officer for Norfolk, a role he served with distinction for 10 years before his retirement from the service in 1989. Remarkably, from 1984 onwards, he served as our head of service alongside his role as St John Ambulance County Commissioner. Bruce was also instrumental in the formation of the Firefighting at Sea team." You're listening to edition number 1981 of The Mardler, recorded on Friday the 22nd August 2025. Still to come, there are items about a row over a memorial, a buddy bench to be installed in a school, and of course, the Mardler magazine supplement. But before all of that, we have a letter to the editor of the North Norfolk News.
Bill Dingle, chairman of the Norfolk and Norwich Liver Group, writes, "On behalf of the Norfolk and Norwich Liver Group, our next meeting is at 11:30 a.m. on Monday, 1st September, at Max Bar, St. John's Roman Catholic Cathedral, Unthank Road, Norwich, NR58HT. Our speaker on this occasion is Dr. Will Gelson, consultant hepatologist with an interest in viral hepatitis, liver transplantation, and biliary disease. Please don't miss this meeting. We are so lucky to receive the time of this brilliant young doctor, who I know will present a fascinating talk."
And now for some local events. The summer sun may have disappeared over the past few days, but there's still plenty going on around the county to tempt you out and about. Fancy a bit of singing? Then maybe go along on Sunday the 31st of August to St Andrew's Methodist Church, Sheringham, who are hosting an outdoors Songs of Praise afternoon. The event starts at 4 p.m. and everyone is welcome. Just bring your voice. On Wednesday the 27th of August, Black Shuck Distillery have invited Vision Norfolk friends to visit their gin distillery at Hindleveston near Fakenham. There will be a guided tour and demonstrations. A minibus will leave the Norwich Hub, Beckham Place, Norwich, at 9:45 a.m. To book a place, please get in touch with Richard Polly on 01603 573000 or email richard.polly@visionnorfolk.org.uk. On the 30th of August, there is a folk and bespoke craft fair at Wells Maltings, Wells next to the sea, And don't forget the North Norfolk Food and Drink Festival at Holcombe on the 30th and 31st of August. Looking ahead to September, why not spend an evening with well-known musician and raconteur Richard Digens, who will be appearing at the Sheringham Little Theatre on September the 7th. Doors open at 7pm and tickets are available via Sheringham Little Theatre's website, www.sheringhamlittletheatre.com. On Monday the 3rd of September, Vision Norfolk, in conjunction with Optelic Low Vision, will be hosting a Vision Zone at the Forum in Norwich from 10am till 2pm. Also present will be representatives from Glaucoma UK, the Macular Society, Age UK Norwich, Chatterbox, Vocal Eyes, Norwich Library Assist, the Virtual School, ORCAM, and local low vision aid supplier Cobalt. Vision Norfolk's photography group will also be displaying some of their photographs. Everyone is welcome, so do pop along. If a quiz is something you fancy doing, then Sunday nights at the Pear Tree Pub in Norwich is just for you. Quizzes start at 7pm, and for more information please ring 07549 012 243. Whatever you do this week, we hope you enjoy it. We now turn to this week's Mardler magazine supplement, which we hope you will enjoy. We hear from some of our Mardler volunteers, encounters of their first vehicle and lucky escapes. We continue with our travels around the Norfolk coast, visiting about the Glaven ports. We also have a look at modern life from a grumpy old man. But let's listen to our first selection, which is read by Barbara, and is from Mardler volunteer Clive McCombie's regular article, My Music For You. Will there be an African flavour, as hinted at last month? Let's find out.
Last month, I suggested that my August contribution might have an African flavour, as I have just returned from a trip to East Africa. I have researched various options and have come to the conclusion that nothing really grabs my attention. Instead, I have come up with the idea of choosing music with the name of a country or city in its title, and so I have chosen works which relate to Italy, Finland, Poland, and India. I wonder if you can guess what I may have chosen. Maybe pause the broadcast and think about your best guesses. The first two may come fairly easily, but the last two may not be quite as obvious. Representing Italy, I have chosen Felix Mendelssohn's Italian Symphony. This is the third time in the last year that this composer has featured in my choices, so in case you haven't already identified my favourite type of classical music, this statistic may give you a clue. Mendelssohn had an insatiable wanderlust, visiting Britain more than once, and on one occasion the visit inspired his Scottish Symphony and the Hebrides Overture. He also travelled throughout his native Germany, and in 1830 he journeyed to Venice at the start of a 10-month tour of Italy. Writing to his parents in the November of that year, he enthused, "Italy at last, and what I have all my life considered as the greatest possible felicity is now begun, and I am basking in it." He loved the ancient buildings, the masterpieces of the Italian Renaissance, and the warm and sunny climate. The symphony is first mentioned in February 1831, whilst he was in Rome. He claims to have made rapid progress with it. Later in Naples, in 1831, it is mentioned again, but it was not until his return to Berlin in 1832 that it really took off, prompted by a commission from the Philharmonic Society in London. The finished product received its first performance in London in the Hanover Square Rooms in May 1833. It received extremely positive comments, especially the slow movement,
reportedly inspired by Felix witnessing a religious procession in Naples. Three further performances in London took place in 1834, 1837 and 1838, but Mendelssohn, who was neurotically self-critical, felt that the work was flawed and the Philharmonic Society agreed that no further performances would take place in his lifetime. Selection number two takes us to a land where Mendelssohn would not have been basking in November, to Finland, the home of Jean Sibelius, a composer of the late Romantic and early modern periods. His music is often credited with helping Finland develop a strong national identity when the country was struggling from several attempts at Russification in the late 19th century. I am tempted to say that 125 years later, plus ça change. The composition, a tone poem, is the last of seven performed as a complement to a tableau depicting episodes from Finnish history. Many have commented that it should really be the Finnish national anthem. It was initially composed for orchestra, but the hymn-like final theme is these days often performed by a choir. It is a standalone piece and one of the most important martial songs of Finland. It is also sung as a Christian hymn to such words as, "Be still, my soul." From Finland, we travel to Poland for the Warsaw Concerto by Richard Adinsel. This is a short work for piano and orchestra, written for the 1941 film Dangerous Moonlight, which is about the Polish struggle against the 1939 invasion by Nazi Germany. In essence, its focus is similar to that of Finlandia. It is written in imitation of the style of Rachmaninoff. Adinsel himself was a Londoner who initially studied law before turning to music. His most memorable contributions are to a series of film scores, including Goodbye, Mr. Chips, the original Gaslight, Scrooge and Dangerous Moonlight. All of them are part of the so-called tabloid concerto genre, and all of them have a classical music style. Finally, my choice of the month. It is a song that I have performed many times and comes from a set of four Indian love lyrics with words written by a favourite Edwardian poet, Lawrence Hope, and music by Amy Woodford Findon. The Indian love lyrics was also a silent film based on the poem The Garden of Karma by Lawrence Hope. Hope had an unconventional life. She was born Adila Violet Corey and used Lawrence Hope as a pseudonym. Prone to depression since childhood, she committed suicide at the age of 39 in 1904. From the four songs, I have selected the Kashmiri song, perhaps better known as Pale Hands I Loved. The poem was set to music in 1902 and, of the four, quickly became a drawing room standard and remained popular until the Second World War. It oozes sentiment and references to the shalimar and lotus buds, clearly aimed to create a Far East atmosphere. In the second half of the last century, ballads such as this were dismissed as trivial, but more recently they have been welcomed back as a reflection of a moment in time and songs which have memorable melodies. I hope as ever that there is something in my selections to please you. It has been a pleasure to present my music for you over the last 13 months, and I hope to be able to continue for a good while yet. Happy listening.
This month, we hear from car enthusiast and modeler friend Alan Groombridge and his recollections of his first vehicle. My very first car was a red and white two-seater open-top Spider. I never insured or taxed it. It had a 2LP, as in leg power, engine, and I used to drive it on the pavement and in the garden, but never on the road. I loved it. Those of you who can, transport yourselves back to the early to mid-1950s. We lived in a nice area in a fairly big house, home to three sets of family members, on a tree-lined leafy avenue. But we were definitely not upmarket, unlike many of our neighbours, who nearly all had cars which I longed to go and pore over. We could not afford a real one, just my little pedal car. Fast forward 12 years or so to 1967. I was working and had managed to save around £150, and the car bug had bitten again. Plus the fact of having wheels would surely impress the girls. I saw a green 1957 four-door Austin A35 for sale locally, outside a large workshop. I went and inquired about it, and was told it had just come in and needed tidying up a bit and a service. The seller said I could have it for £125. He had some other cars that I looked at, but they were wrecks compared to the A35. He said come back in a week or so, and it would be ready for sale and that I would get first dibs. The A35 was christened Belinda. It had central locking. If you sat in the middle, you could push all the door buttons down. I personalised it by sticking diamond-quilted imitation leather over the dashboard and door cappings. Having a car meant there were more places we could visit and more time to have fun. No more running to catch the last bus home in the evening. Of course, driving lessons then just taught you how to pass the test, not how to drive safely, and sprightly cornering was not one of the A35's strong points, which I found out rather dramatically. Box Hill in Surrey had, and still might have, an access road that had quite a few tight bends in it as it wound its way up to the top. My girlfriend Chris and I enjoyed a picnic on Box Hill and were driving back down to go home. I took one of the tight bends much too fast and understeered off the road, and we rolled sideways down the hill. It's rather disconcerting to see terra firma rotating in front of your eyes, along with crashing and banging noises. But thankfully it all stopped after a couple of rotations and everything went very quiet. We'd been stopped from going all the way to the bottom of the hill by a tree, not much thicker than a pint beer mug, passenger side down. I kicked the driver's door open and we scrambled out rather shaken. Apart from a cut on the top of Chris's right wrist from the driving mirror, which in the A35 was just a piece of glass with no frame or surround, when she put her arms up to protect her head, we were unhurt. After a trip to the hospital and the police station, we phoned for a recovery truck for the car and Chris's mum to come and collect us. We agreed to say that we had hit a rock on the side of the road, which had damaged the car, making it unsafe to drive. Chris's mum was lovely about it all, but her dad didn't seem very understanding. The next day at work, one of his colleagues mentioned to him that he had seen a young couple in a green A35 going too fast on a bend on the Box Hill Road and go over the side. Well, as you can guess, I was not flavour of the month with Chris's father for a while, and he was rather monosyllabic towards me for a time. Her mum was much more understanding. The car was remarkably undamaged, save for some very minor dents and scratches, as far as I can remember, and we were soon driving it again. It was reliable transport for quite some time, but was involved in another crash when a car just drove across us at a junction where we had priority. We were unhurt, but dear old Belinda was a write-off. Chris still has the scar on her wrist. I then bought a second-hand Mark I Ford Escort in Anchor Blue. But I think this is where the story comes full circle. The lovely feeling of driving my little red and white open-top pedal car must have lodged in my memory banks, jogged over time by passenger rides in various open MGs and a Sunbeam Alpine. Emma Peel's Lotus Elan and the Prisoner's Lotus 7 also adding fuel to a smouldering fire. Then later, with mortgage paid off, retirement looming, and Terry, the bass player in my band, wanting to sell his roadster, all the stars aligned. And the result was a much-cherished 1998 BMW 2.8-litre Z3, who is known affectionately as Zelda. Fortunately, she takes the corner better than the old A35.
Today we continue our journey of the Norfolk coast with more excerpts from the book 2 Points East, written beautifully from our Mardler friend and Elsham author Judith Ellis. Before we pop along the coast to the Glaven ports, we come across the village of Stiffkey. Lying on the coast between Mawston and Wells, Stiffkey occupies the area of salt marsh where the Stiffkey River meets the sea. This river was used for the transport of stone from France via Blakeney for the building of Walsingham and Binham Priories. Stiffkey remains known now for the tale of its defrocked vicar and for its cockles, known as Stooky Blues. The cockles are stained blue by the local mud, but let's hear more about the naughty vicar, Harold Davidson, who became the rector of Stiffkey in 1902. He has become very concerned for the prostitutes in London, and spent a great deal of time there rescuing fallen women. Unfortunately, in 1932, when Davidson was in his 60s, a Fleet Street reporter picked up on his apparent misbehaviour, and the story of his church trial went worldwide. He was defrocked in Norwich Cathedral in 1932. He then joined a circus, and while he was taking the part of Daniel in the lion's den, preaching from inside the lion's cage, the usually docile lion, Freddie, attacked him, and Harold died of his injuries a few days later. And so we continue along the coast to the River Glaven, which was shallow and had no tributaries to connect it with major inland settlements. However, it was very fast flowing, which made it a good river for watermills, and nonetheless it had four ports, which were Blakeney, Clye, Wiverton, and the much smaller one of Salthouse, which has long since disappeared. Blakeney is often referred to as Snitterley, and there is an unresolved question as to whether Snitterley was a separate settlement from Blakeney, or whether it just changed its name at some point. The process of longshore drift, whereby the currents bring sand and shingle down the coast and the backwash of the incoming tide brings it into the shore, builds up the long spits which are such a feature of the low-lying coast of East Anglia. Blakeney was an important port in the Middle Ages, protected by the ever-lengthening shingle spit, now called Blakeney Point. The coastline looked very different in the Middle Ages when the Glaven estuary came inland as far as Clye Church. The quay was by the church at Newgate Green, with Wiverton Church across the water on the other side. By the 16th century, the spit had grown into a protective arm sheltering the harbour. A map of the area, dated 1586, raises some interesting points. The arm of the Glaven reached as far as Salthouse, which for a time was also a port, until the constant sighting... Which for a time was also a port, until the constant silting up of the channel made navigation impossible. By the 16th century, most of the fishing boats were going off to fish the coast of Iceland. The migratory habits of the fish had changed, and the North Sea had its dangers of navigation over the treacherous sandbanks. In 1516, a charter was granted to Blakeney, giving it the exclusive rights to supply the priories of Binham and Walsingham with fish. In the first half of the 19th century, extensive beds of oysters were found off Brancaster, and oyster fattening pits were made at Brancaster and Blakeney. By 1870, there were 18 oyster smacks dredging for oysters in Blakeney Harbour. The beds were eventually overfished and the trade declined. The Wells craft were called flat bottoms, and the Blakeney ones were canoes. They were usually about 15 foot long and 3 foot wide. They were either rowed or poled and sometimes carried a lug sail as well. There were still many being used right up to 1950, but now the only one remaining is in the Museum of East Anglian Life in Stowmarket. When fishing was bad, piracy and smuggling thrived. The old custom house at Clye has a wooden frieze above the front door showing four customs men and an officer with a drawn sword surprising two smugglers unloading a ship onto a pack horse. In 1612, the Great Fire destroyed 117 buildings in Clye. The town was rebuilt further towards the sea at the position of the current windmill. And not only that, but you can also stay there, as it is an unusual bed and breakfast establishment. Next month, it's all about lifeboats, but if you can't wait that long, you can purchase the book in audible version by visiting www.thebookstudio.co.uk. You will be pleased to hear that the recordings also incorporate the sounds of boats, coast and marsh, as well as original recordings of two folk musicians on melodeon, flute and fiddle.
Our next article is a wry look at life, written by Mardler friend Chris Porter, entitled Man's Best Friend by a Grumpy Old Man. Once upon a time, a man's best friend, or for that matter a lady's, would invariably refer to ownership of a dog. Whilst accommodating such creatures may still be common, these days there's a far more popular and annoying attachment, as was demonstrated to me just the other evening. On a calm summer's evening, we were joined in our garden by three young relatives in their late teens or early 20s. We sat peacefully watching the sun sink slowly behind the trees and began listening to beautiful birdsong. Instead of relaxed enjoyment, however, our guests immediately became restless, extracted their phones and pointing them at the tree. In a few seconds, one of them victoriously announced it was a Eurasian blackbird. The movement and noise, of course, meant the immediate end of the bird's song. Only a short time later, referring to a blackbird, I was firmly corrected that it was in fact a Eurasian blackbird, because that's what their phones said. Since the term refers to most of the world, is it really necessary to use it? And anyway, are there any non-Eurasian blackbirds? Nevertheless, Grandad was wrong. The next conversation topic related to the recent death of a celebrity, and mistakenly querying his age, this led to the end of any pleasant conversation, while phones were tapped to eventually produce a birth date of 15th June 1969. Music was next on the topic list, and in particular, a band called Velvet Sundown, whose album Floating on Echoes has been the most digitally played for many months. Despite an accompanying picture of four men in denim jackets, however, it transpires the whole thing was an AI creation. So despite their popularity, you'll never see them walk on stage. Finally, someone's phone began to ring, prompting the comment, "Oh, I must take this, it's the boss." Followed by 5 minutes of one-sided, meaningless conversation. Please take me back to days when work could be forgotten at the close of day, and then for at least 12 hours. From then on, it was three silent guests, each busy messaging others with heads bowed, phone resting on fingers, while the thumb flicked at amazing speed over the screen. How could whatever they were writing possibly be accurate in terms of spelling, grammar, or punctuation? Being a technically minded person myself, I do have a phone, but I just can't remember where it is at the moment. And having signed up to our village messaging website, I regularly see the results of messages sent by the flicking thumb method and relying on predictive text and AI. For example, is there a plumber available to service my boiler? It's a taxi. Presumably the popular make, Baxi. These days I do all my cooking with my hairdryer. Air fryer, possibly? And do join our ladies' sewers group. I didn't know there were ladies' sewers. I thought we all shared the same ones. Oh, let's bring back the days of the morning clink of the letterbox and the flap of Elizabethan stamped envelopes landing on the doormat as you run down the stairs to see what's arrived. Those were the days, my friend, we thought we'd never.
And those items conclude this week's magazine supplement. Our thanks go to the authors of these articles for their contributions.
Returning to the news, our penultimate selection of articles includes the Swing Jazz Picnic to make a return, and there is a new pilgrim trail for Norfolk.
For more than a century, the Cromer War Memorial has been the focal point of the town's remembrance services. But now the monument is at the centre of an extraordinary row over who was responsible for it, as well as for other important public assets in the town. The argument has seen Tim Adams, leader of North Norfolk District Council, send a fiery letter to Cromer Town Council, accusing it of trying to offload its responsibility for the memorial. He also claimed Cromer Town Councillors want to cherry-pick the town's most valuable assets for themselves to run. And in a further twist, his letter also confirmed that his council would be pulling out of further talks with the town council, saying they could no longer be trusted as a viable strategic partner.
A new multicoloured buddy bench has been installed in the playground at Sheringham Woodfield School as a tribute to a former pupil. The bench is a tribute to Luke Blower, who died in 2023 at the age of 22. He attended the school from 2004 to 2020 and was highly regarded by those who cared for him. Luke had complex learning and health needs, and his parents, Julie and Jason Lamb, wanted a lasting memorial to honour his memory. They believed a buddy bench, where children can sit to signal they would like someone to talk or play with, would be enjoyed by many pupils at the school. Luke's mother, Julie, said, "The team here at Sheringham Woodfield School did so much for Luke. They played a huge part in his life, enabling him to participate in so many activities, going with him on school outings, even accompanying him when he needed to travel to Norwich or King's Lynn for hospital appointments." Sheringham Woodfield School is a purpose-built facility for 158 pupils with complex learning and health needs, supported by more than 160 staff.
A popular North Norfolk event is set to return after a four-year break. The Swing Jazz Picnic will make its comeback on September 13th at the Hoverton Hall Estate near Wroxham. It will feature vocalist Gary Winter, supported by the Doghouse Big Band. The event which will run between 2 p.m. and 4:30 p.m., invites audiences to bring their own chairs and picnics to enjoy an afternoon of swing music. Rachel Buxton, who owns and runs the estate with her husband Harry, said, "We are so pleased to see it return after such a long break. We know how much the audiences that attend enjoy it." Tickets for the event are £25 per person and children under 12 can attend for free. Parking is free and the event is accessible for all abilities. Book at hovtonhallestate.co.uk/whats-on/.
A new pilgrimage trail has been created linking several North Norfolk churches along a route of more than 10 miles. The trail begins at St Peter's Church in Sheringham and ends at the Church of the Head of John the Baptist in Trimmingham, once a major pilgrimage destination in medieval times. Named From Brokenness to New Life, the route weaves in and out of the King Charles III coastal path, taking in several parish churches along the way. The Trimmingham Church was historically significant because it once housed an alabaster head of John the Baptist, a replica of the relic at St Amiens in France. Although the head was later destroyed, the church's name preserves its legacy. Julie Rubidge from St Peter's said, "Do take the trail and experience this special new pilgrimage for yourself. Walkers can complete the trail at their own pace or follow it virtually using a printed or digital guide available from St Peter's Church or online." Our last few articles cover a Norfolk boutique hotel named the best in the UK, hundreds flock to a village for a small but mighty event, and a cafe owner celebrates a big dream.
A boutique hotel nestled on the edge of a country estate has been named the UK's best. The Victoria is a four-star venue between the parkland around Holcombe Hall and the golden sands of Holcombe Beach. Locally known as the Vic, the hotel offers 20 uniquely decorated rooms across two period buildings. There is also a selection of four self-catering shepherd's huts available to hire. The Vic has its own on-site restaurant, which is led by head chef Michael Chamberlain and has won 2 AA Rosettes in 2023. This is a holiday that even the dogs can enjoy, as they are welcome on both the beach and the main hotel building all year round. The Independent recently published an article highlighting the best hotels for families to stay in across the UK, and the Vic was included as the best boutique spot. This is not the first time the Independent has named it one of the best. In 2022, the publication highlighted it in an article ranking the most dog-friendly stays. Last summer, Condé Nast Traveller also recommended it in a piece that called Holcombe one of the loveliest locations to visit in the autumn.
Hundreds of visitors turned out to celebrate a day of fundraising, fun and life-saving demonstration at Haysborough RNLI's Open Day. The event at Cart Gap saw guests have the chance to meet the crew, tour the station and see the D-class lifeboat Russell Pickering up close. The day raised nearly £1,200, with a further £744 generated through sales at the station's shop. Rachel Kirkham, lifeboat operations manager at Haysborough RNLI, said, "Thank you all for your wonderful help and engaging with our community and visitors today. We have raised just short of £1,200 today and the shop £744. Small but mighty." The open day featured live music from Jay and Ross and the Norwich Ukulele Society, along with a barbecue, refreshments and games for all ages. Visitors met the full crew, including boat and shore teams, the visits team and water safety officers. The RNLI's water safety team and lifeguards spoke with families about staying safe near the water and demonstrated the use of throw lines and other life-saving equipment. The event also drew interest from those looking to join the RNLI's One Crew and find out more about volunteer roles. Station volunteers extended their thanks to everyone who attended, including both residents and visitors.
A business owner who's opened her first coffee shop on Norfolk's coastline is celebrating after achieving her big dream. Georgia Cleaver, a former student of Aylsham High School, first launched her business, Tide and Earth, 5 years ago. And what originally began with the creation of her handcrafted jewellery line quickly expanded as she went on to open a coffee trailer 3 years ago in Buxton. Now she's opened the doors on her latest business venture in Sheringham, inspired by television shows such as Paradise Cafe and Friends. She said, "Ever since I was little, I always wanted to have a coffee shop or cafe, and one that all my friends could gather at. I got to a point where I was like, I want this to go a bit bigger than this, and I just wanted that big dream to come true. So when this place came up, I just thought, why not? I won't know unless I try." Following its opening a month ago, Ms. Cleaver described how the experience had been positively wild. She added, "It's just been this beautiful whirlwind of lovely people coming through the door, the loveliest people. I just want to say a massive thank you to Sheringham, because I've had the warmest welcome onto the High Street, and it's been so beautiful, and I'm so grateful." Going forward, there are plans to host jewellery workshops throughout autumn and winter, as well as wreath-making workshops and ceramic workshops at Tide and Earth. Miss Cleaver is also a self-taught silversmith, and the cafe features a small desk where she spends her Mondays, when the cafe is closed, making jewellery to sell. All of it's made from using 100% recycled sterling silver and sea glass from along Norfolk's coast. The aim is for those on holiday or moving away to be able to have a connection to the sea and the county with them at all times. Miss Cleaver described her love of Sheringham as important, as her grandparents lived there. She said she'd come full circle with the opening of her business and recalled memories of collecting stones on the beach with her granddad to paint and of dressing crabs together.
And that brings us to the end of this edition of The Mardler with readings from the North Norfolk News. If you have any comments or queries, you can contact our listener liaison officer, Imogen Mortensen, on 01263 587 610.
Perhaps we should just mention that if you have a smartphone, tablet or computer, or know someone who has, you can listen to this and other editions online at mardler.org.uk. You can also use an Alexa smart speaker, a variety of smartphone apps, or even a telephone call to listen. Find out the details on our website, mardler.org.uk.
We rely on receiving your returned memory sticks and pouches so that we can continue to send you new editions each week. So please remember to return the pouch and memory stick promptly, making sure to reverse the label first.
The sound engineer today was Richard Preston, editing and producing this issue was Tracy Newsome. Colleagues in the copying and dispatch room join us in wishing you the best of health, and we look forward to joining you again in a week's time. But for now, it's cheerio!